to sustain myself in this maelstrom of activity known as civilization. Nay, I am richer than most millionaires because I depend upon a source of inspired power which reveals itself to me from within, while many of the wealthy men find it necessary to turn for power and stimulation to the stock ticker. My source of power is as free as the air I breathe. To avail myself of it at will, I need only faith, and this I have in abundance. An experience that led to revelation of the power of faith. I shall now describe the most dramatic experience of my entire labor of research in the field of causes of success and failure. This true story is intimately associated with a type of personal experience in connection with which no one would wish to exaggerate or treat lightly any of the details. The story concerns my son Blair, the second of three sons. I have been left no choice but to relate the story, even though it is highly personal for mention. After all, I am a student of life, and my time has been and will continue to be devoted to the study of the causes by which people may avoid poverty and misery. I feel compelled to describe my experience with Blair because his entire life has, almost miraculously, provided evidence of the manner in which the law of faith can be made to work in the practical affairs of life. I shall have to go back to the time of Blair's birth to give an accurate picture of the beginning of this colorful life drama. As the story unfolds, I want you to notice that Blair's case provides evidence of the irresistible power of faith. Keep this thought in mind, and the story will be its own explanation of why I crossed the sacred threshold of family relationship for evidence with which to convey the nature and method of operation of one of nature's inexorable laws. Blair came into this world without physical ears. He did not have even the outer signs of ears, and subsequent X-ray examinations by noted physicians disclosed the fact that he did not have even as much as an opening in the skull. The doctors in attendance at his birth took me aside and told me as gently as possible that the child would never hear or speak. "He will hear," I replied, "and he will speak." What made me throw back at the doctors such a seemingly foolish challenge is something I will never know, but I can describe, and this description is important, how I felt when I did so. The feeling came over me when I heard the uncompromising opinion of finality of the doctors that nothing was impossible. For years I had been lecturing to others, telling them, without any qualifications whatever, two very definite beliefs of mine, viz. 1. With every adversity comes the seed of an equivalent advantage. There never has been, and there probably never will be, an exception to this rule, because it is a part of nature's own plan, as described by Emerson in his essay on compensation. 2. The only real limitation is the one we establish in our own minds through lack of faith. Whatever limitations the mind establishes, the mind can also eliminate. I had been emphasizing these two statements for years, but now I was forced to meet a factual circumstance in the form of a newly born baby with an irreparable physical affliction which seemed to knock the very foundation from under both of these rules. It was the most dramatic experience of my life. On the one hand, I saw physical evidence of limitation which apparently no mind had created and no mind could eliminate. Also, I saw physical evidence of a newly born baby handicapped by a form of adversity which, as far as any reasoning mind could evaluate, could never yield the seed of an equivalent advantage. What advantage, some silent voice of mockery asked, could there possibly be to a human being born with no ears and condemned, therefore, to eternal deprivation of hearing and speech? The answer to that challenge was not forthcoming as far as my reasoning mind was concerned, but something inside me, some other form of intelligence with a more optimistic trend and an affinity for faith, answered the challenge in no uncertain terms. The answer assumed a form of thought which ran something like this. I do not know at this time what seed of advantage there is in being born without ears, but I do know there is an equivalent advantage, and I shall find it. I did not at the time of Blair's birth, nor at any time afterward, accept in my own mind the physical reality of a child condemned hopelessly to loss of hearing and speech. I moved on the theory, to me it was more than a theory, that sometime, somehow, I would find the seed of an advantage equivalent to the handicap brought over by the earless child, and that I would help him cause the seed to germinate and grow to some practical advantage sufficient to compensate him for his lack of ears. As this dramatic story is unfolded, you will observe, as clearly as you can see your own face in a mirror, that, one, I established in my own mind the mental image of a condition that would give Blair the use of hearing and speech, and, two, this image was taken over by some unknown natural law and translated into a physical reality. The evidence is indisputable, and fortunately, it is of such a nature that no one is under the necessity of accepting my statements as the only means of verifying the facts concerning the case. No fewer than 50 other people, consisting of doctors who examined Blair from time to time, teachers who gave him instruction in school, and other close associates and relatives, are as familiar as I with all but one important feature of the case. I am the only person who created a mental impulse of thought at the time of Blair's birth, which reflected a correction of his deficiency. And I am the only person who nursed that thought continuously through faith until it found a way to manifest itself in physical form. You will have to accept my word for this part of the story. Everything else is amply corroborated. While Blair was a child in arms, there was no indication that he could hear. In fact, there was every indication that he could not. I have reference now to the first few months after his birth. When he was about 6 months old, his mother made the astonishing discovery that she could awaken him by speaking very gently, just above his head. From that time on, his hearing began to improve noticeably, until finally he could hear the sound of one's voice, although he made no attempt to talk until he was past 2 years of age. About that time, I discovered he could hear much better when I placed my lips against the side of his head when I spoke. Acting on this lead, I began to practice talking to him with my lips touching his head. Remember, this was long before the modern use of bone conduction, which is now employed so effectively by the manufacturers of hearing aids. One day I noticed that Blair seemed almost hypnotized by the sound of the Victrola. So I picked him up and placed his head against the sounding board. This caused him to let out a series of gurgling sounds, which resembled an attempt to laugh. After that, I equipped the Victrola so he could reach it, and he soon learned to operate the machine himself. He was so fascinated that he often stood by it and played one selection after another for hours at a time. Meanwhile, Blair was under the constant attention and observation of a noted ear specialist in Chicago, who expressed amazement at the child's ability to hear at all. This case was so puzzling that the doctor called in a group of the best-known ear specialists, and between them, they took many types of X-ray pictures of the child's skull in their endeavor to unravel the secret of his hearing. These examinations were continued at intervals of every few months until Blair reached the age of 9. Then the doctor operated on one side of the child's head, for the purpose of learning what, if anything, in the way of hearing equipment, was under the skin. We learned then, for the first time, that there was no opening in the skull for the canal, and not any sign of ear equipment. This discovery made the case more of a puzzle than ever. Nothing like it had ever been known in the annals of medical science. There had been other cases of children born without ears, but none of them had developed hearing ability. This was the feature of the case which had, and still has, the doctors puzzled. After an X-ray examination of Blair's skull, made by another noted ear specialist from New York City, he reported to me, "Theoretically, Blair has no right to hear a sound, yet he actually hears some sounds of such a high rate of vibration that you and I cannot hear them." Generally speaking, medical science does not recognize the power of the mind as an agency which has sufficient force to provide a means of conveying sound to the brain without the aid of some ear equipment. But the psychologist does recognize such a power as existing in the mind. I speak of the type of psychologist who has tested his knowledge by the practical affairs of life through the trial and error method. The type who recognizes that the energy which keeps the stars and planets in their proper relationship and relates every atom of matter to its associated atoms in a natural, harmonious manner can and does impart knowledge to the human brain by other than the 5 physical senses. As soon as I discovered that I could make Blair hear me by touching his head with my lips, I began to experiment with him. Here again, I feel impelled to ask the reader to observe very carefully the details of what I am about to relate, for these details, as small and seemingly commonplace as they are, carry the most important evidence of the law of the power of faith. Having found a way to reach Blair's brain and convey sound to him, I began, when he was about 3 years old, to tell him tall stories of what he and I were going to do when he grew to manhood. Instead of ignoring his physical handicap, as many of his relatives believed we should, I based practically all my stories on the affliction by telling Blair the time would come, after he grew up, when the lack of ears would be his greatest asset. Frankly, I did not know at that time just how this promise was going to be fulfilled, but something plainly urged me to go on with the building of Blair's world of make-believe, and so I did. My desire to help Blair convert this physical handicap into an advantage was so great that I felt assured I would find some practical means of aiding him in doing so. Thus, we see there is a definite relationship between strong desire and faith. For example, I told Blair that when he became old enough to sell papers, he could sell more papers than other boys because people would go out of their way to patronize him, seeing, as they would, that he had the courage to sell papers despite his lack of ears. Perhaps I had sufficient knowledge in my subconscious mind as to how Blair could convert his handicap into an advantage to induce the faith I had in that reality. How prophetic a truth that promise was! Long before he was old enough to take a paper route, Blair began to request the privilege of doing so. His mother opposed the plan on the grounds that he would be subjected, because of his poor hearing, to the hazards of the street. I favored his ambition on the grounds that the experience would give him confidence and help him to adjust himself to life in a natural way, without developing inhibitions because of his affliction. There the matter stood. One evening, while his mother and I were at the theater, Blair slipped away from his nurse, went down the street to the shoemaker, borrowed 6 cents in capital, and invested it in newspapers. He soon sold his stock, reinvested, and sold more, until he had earned enough in profits to pay back the 6 cents and had 42 cents in profits. When we got home, he was in bed asleep, his hands filled with pennies, nickels, and dimes. His mother stood by the bed and cried when she saw him. I stood by the bed and laughed. The difference in what we saw was this. His mother saw a poor little afflicted boy who had been subjected to the dangers of the street while trying to earn money he did not need. I saw a brave little businessman who was beginning to demonstrate the truth of the things I had been telling him about his affliction, becoming an asset instead of a liability. I also saw the fulfillment of the promise of faith on which I had so adamantly relied. Blair was 5 years old when he began selling papers. Already, he had accepted the belief that his affliction was no handicap, and had begun to demonstrate this truth because he sold more papers than any boy on the street. Later, he took the agency for the Saturday Evening Post and led the sales of the entire force of boys in his territory. He had more enthusiasm, initiative, and imagination than the majority of adults ever develop. When he wanted anything, such as a bicycle or an electric train, he never asked us to give it to him. Instead, he asked for the privilege of earning the money to buy whatever he wanted. On one occasion, he wanted an electric train that cost more than we believed he should spend for it, so Blair took the matter out of our hands by canvassing all the neighbors and selling his services. He cleaned the snow from the walks to provide the money needed. Blair was able to compete with other children who had normal hearing, and he actually excelled most of them in all matters of importance. Just after the doctor operated on Blair's head and discovered that he had no hearing equipment, Blair was 9 years of age. My work of research in the organization of the Law of Success philosophy then made it necessary for me to travel throughout the country. Blair's mother took him to her hometown in West Virginia, where he completed the public school, after which he entered the University of West Virginia. My influence over him ceased, therefore, at about the age of 9. Despite the fact that he had developed only about 60% of his normal hearing, Blair went through the graded schools, high school, and 4 years of college, making grades as high as the best of his classmates, who possessed normal hearing. He had not been taught lip reading, nor had he been permitted to see such a thing as sign language. During the time I had the responsibility of influencing Blair's mind, I never permitted him to attend the schools for underprivileged children, and carefully kept him away from all reminders that his affliction was an insurmountable handicap. My purpose was deliberate because I did not want him to develop inferiority complexes or the feeling that he could not accomplish whatever I told him he could. Every year, until Blair was 9, I had difficulty in getting the school authorities to allow him to enter the regular classes, because his presence made it necessary for the teachers to show him extra consideration by placing him in the front seats and by special attention in his classes. On one such occasion, I came to a deadlock with the school authorities. Accordingly, I placed Blair in a private school rather than permit the school authorities to send him to a school for underprivileged children. These details may seem commonplace, but they are rich with meaning. They indicate how definitely I made up my mind not to accept Blair's affliction as being without a remedy. I was determined that he should pick up my state of mind and act upon it as his own. Quite without full knowledge of the real significance and far-reaching effects of all I was doing, I was actually building the pattern, or blueprint, or impulse of thought, call it whatever you will, which was to take over, and did take over, and translate into its equivalent benefit, the handicap with which Blair was born. Keep in mind the fact that my path and Blair's seldom crossed, except for an occasional visit, from the time he was 9 until he finished college and was ready for me to cooperate with him directly again. This time I was able to make good on the promise I had made during his early childhood that I would somehow see that he got his opportunity in life after he finished school and was ready for it. That promise, as I learned afterward, was always present in his mind while he was going through school. It was doubly present in my mind. I never for one moment doubted that one day I would find a place for Blair, where he would be of great service to the world and at the same time become self-determining despite his affliction. In 1936, Blair finished his work at the university, strangely, but not more so than the other parts of this life drama of which Blair was a part. About 3 weeks before completing his work at the university, he came across a mechanical hearing aid of the bone construction type, and discovered that it supplied the extra hearing capacity he needed to give him the equivalent of normal hearing. For the first time in his life, he was able to hear all that his instructors said in class. Apparently, his discovery of this hearing aid was the result of chance. The entire story cannot be dismissed as due to that cause. The law of chance seldom operates so favorably to an individual that it saves him from being a deaf-mute and helps him to convert his affliction into his greatest asset. More often, the law of chance apparently works in the opposite direction, by undermining every opportunity of success because of some misfortune or physical handicap. Blair was so elated over his find that he wrote me about it. Meanwhile, he had dispatched a letter to the manufacturer of the hearing aid, informing him of the discovery. I answered his letter immediately, requesting him to come on to New York, prepared to remain. For I saw clearly that the big opportunity through which Blair could convert his handicap into an asset was at hand. When Blair arrived in New York, I was busily engaged at work on the manuscript of a book. I dropped all work on the book and placed my combined resources of experience and knowledge back of Blair. Within a few weeks, we had planned his entire line of procedure, mapped it, and placed it on paper so it could be easily presented to others. He then took the plan to the hearing aid manufacturer and with it sold himself to the company at a starting salary of $2,600 a year and traveling expenses. If there was ever a natural find of great value to a corporation, that find was made by the company that employed Blair. They readily recognized and acknowledged this fact because they had found in Blair a hard-of-hearing case unparalleled anywhere in the world. And he had proved that the instrument had helped to correct a portion of the deficiency in that case. Other manufacturers of hearing aids became aware of Blair's presence in New York and were intent upon employing him. While I was preparing Blair to accept his position, he lived with me, and I had ample opportunity to analyze and study him at close range. This privilege proved to be a blessing. It resulted in my tearing up the manuscript on which I was working and rewriting the book for the purpose of including in it some of the important truths reflected by the present generation. Blair began his new position, and I began studying in him a typical individual product of our modern educational system and family life. It is my belief that no young man ever came out of college at any time or anywhere and went directly into such an appropriate and promising position as the one Blair entered. His employer was highly elated because he had found in Blair a marvelous subject for laboratory tests through whom the hearing aid could be tested and greatly improved, to say nothing of having found a person whose case was so positively unique that it claimed the attention of medical experts, specialists, and technicians in the hearing aid field. The company was so pleased with the purchase of Blair's services that it began at once to send him to various places to speak before gatherings. The company's publicity experts began to write stories about his case, which commanded free publicity almost everywhere it was given out. To make a long story short, the world of make-believe I had created for Blair had begun to come true. The experience reminded me somewhat of an oil promoter who salted a Texas farm with crude oil and sold it for what seemed to be a fabulous sum on the representation that it contained oil, only to see the sucker who bought it bring in a large oil well. I had discharged my obligation to Blair, but in doing so, I had made a discovery of such enduring importance that I felt it necessary to rewrite the book on which I was working, so I might include a part of my discovery. My motive in helping my son to minimize the disadvantages of his physical affliction was that of paternal love. But the continuous and ardent application of faith which I had put into the task led me at long last into an understanding of the natural law that holds together the two opposing forces of the electron, keeps the stars and planets in their proper relationship to, and the proper distance from, one another, weaves together the personalities of people in a spirit of harmony or antagonism according to the states of mind of the individuals, maintains the seasons, and causes every living thing on earth to reproduce its kind, to say nothing of performing other equally important duties. Right now, however, we are interested in the method by which one may transmute one's thoughts into their physical equivalent and determine the manner in which people relate themselves to one another, for it is in these relationships that we determine our own destinies of success or failure. Dr. Henry C. Link alleges, "Our educational system is concentrated on mental development and has failed to give any understanding of the way emotional and personality habits are acquired or corrected. Everyone knows that practically everything we do, from the time we begin to walk until death, is the result of habit. Walking and talking are habits. Our manner of eating and drinking is a habit. Our sex activities are the results of habit. Our relationship to other people, whether one of harmony or antagonism, is the result of habit. But no one has yet discovered why we form habits. With a limited store of specialized knowledge of a scientific character, Henry Ford made a great success in creating a fortune and building a great industrial empire. Mr. Ford succeeded by developing definite success habits. As far as the knowledge represented by scientific training is concerned, he has a staff of trained experts on his payrolls. From these employees, he acquires the specific knowledge which he needs in practical affairs. Most people know just as little of the causes of financial success as they know of the manner in which people acquire habits. We know that Andrew Carnegie, with only a smattering of schooling, accumulated a fortune of more than $400 million. But what most men do not know is the exact manner in which a man with so little education was able to accumulate such a large fortune. It is just now becoming obvious that the Carnegie fortune was the inevitable result of the self-developed and self-imposed habits of Mr. Carnegie. This great financial achievement was due perhaps more to this discipline than to the efforts of the members of his mastermind to whom he gave credit for the accumulation of his money. For after all, it was the Carnegie mental attitude, created by the dominating Carnegie thought habits, which was maintained by the members of his mastermind and made to serve as a pattern for the guidance of their efforts. In substance, Emerson said, "Every business is the extended shadow of one man." Yes, and if you get an accurate picture of the man who dominates the business, you will see clearly the maker of the habits which determine the success or the failure of the business. You will see also, if you look carefully, that the habit builder of a business who moves with definiteness of plan and purpose usually succeeds. He is the Henry Ford, the Andrew Carnegie, the Thomas Edison, the John D. Rockefeller, So, someone exclaims, it is the individual, after all, who determines whether a business succeeds or fails, and not the automatic working of faith or cosmic habit force. The answer is yes and no. The individual cuts the pattern of a business through his mental attitude and his thought habits, but faith converts that pattern into balances in red or black ink according to the nature of the habits. My conclusions on this subject are more than personal opinions, as I shall hope to prove later. Knowledge is not power. As incredible as it may seem, knowledge of itself is not the cause of success. It required almost 30 years of research for me to prove the truth of this conclusion. I utterly overlooked the real cause of success and failure until I came into a better understanding of faith, the force back of all habits. Faith translates them into their material counterparts of success and enables one to put knowledge to work. Habits are inseparably related to the ego. Therefore, let us leave my personal story here and turn to the analysis of this greatly misunderstood subject in its relationship to the development of faith. Before we begin the analysis of ego, let us recognize that it is the medium through which faith and all other states of mind operate. Throughout this chapter, great emphasis has been placed upon the distinction between passive faith and active faith. The ego is the medium of expression of all action. Therefore, we must know something of its nature and possibilities. We must learn how to stimulate the ego and how to control and guide it. Above all, we must disabuse our minds of the popular error of believing the ego to be only the medium of expression of vanity. The word ego is of Latin origin, and it means I. But it also means a driving force which can be organized and made to serve as the medium for translating desire into faith through action. The misunderstood power of ego. As everyone knows, the word ego has reference to all the factors of one's personality. It is therefore obvious that the ego is subject to development, guidance, and control through the principle of habit. A great philosopher who had devoted his entire life to the study of the human body and mind provided us with a practical foundation for the study of the ego when he said, "Your body, whether living or dead, is a collection of millions of little energies that can never die. These energies are separate and individual. At times they act in some degree of harmony. The human body is a drifting mechanism of life, capable but not accustomed to control the forces within, except as habit, will, cultivation, or special excitement may marshal these forces to the accomplishment of some important end. We are satisfied from many experiments that this power of marshaling and using these energies can be, in every person, cultivated to a high degree. The air, sunlight, food and water you take are agents of a force that comes from the sky and earth. You idly float upon the tide of circumstances to make up your day's life, and the opportunities of being something better than you are drift beyond your reach and pass away. Humanity is hemmed in by so many influences that, from time immemorial, no real effort has been made to gain control of the impulses that run loose in the world. It has been, and still is, easier to let things do as they will rather than exert the will to direct them. But the dividing line between success and failure is found at the stage where aimless drifting ceases. We are all creatures of emotions, passions, circumstances, and accident. What the mind will be, what the heart will be, what the body will be, are problems which are shaped by the drift of life, even when special attention is given to any of them. If you will sit down and think for a while, you will be surprised to know how much of your life has been mere drift. Look at any created life and see its efforts to express itself. The tree sends its branches toward the sunlight, struggles through its leaves to inhale air, and, even underground, sends forth its roots in search of water. This you call inanimate life, but it represents a force that comes from some source and operates for some purpose. There is no place on the globe where energy is not found. The air is so loaded with it that in the cold north the sky shines in boreal rays, and wherever the frigid temperature yields to the warmth, the electric conditions may alarm man. Water is but a liquid union of gases and is charged with electrical, mechanical, and chemical energies, any one of which is capable of doing great service and great damage to man. Even ice, in its coldest phase, has energy, for it is not subdued, nor even still. Its force has broken mountain rocks into fragments. This energy about us we are drinking in water, eating in food, and breathing in air. Not a chemical molecule is free from it. Not an atom can exist without it. We are a combination of individual energies. Man consists of two forces, one tangible in the form of his physical body, with its myriads of individual cells, each endowed with intelligence and energy, and the other intangible, in the form of an ego, the organized dictator which may control his thoughts and deeds. The tangible portion of a man weighing 160 pounds is composed of about 15 chemical elements, all of which are known. They are 95 pounds of oxygen, 38 pounds of carbon, 15 pounds of hydrogen, 4 pounds of nitrogen, 4.5 pounds of calcium, 6 ounces of chlorine, 4 ounces of sulfur, 3.5 ounces of potassium, 3 ounces of sodium, 1/4 ounce of iron, 2.5 ounces of fluorine, 2 ounces of magnesium, 1.5 ounces of silicon, small traces of arsenic, iodine, and aluminum. These tangible parts of man are worth approximately 80 cents, and may be purchased in any modern chemical plant. Add to these 15 chemical elements a well-developed and properly controlled ego, and they may be worth any price the owner sets upon them. The ego is a power which cannot be purchased at any price, but it can be developed and shaped to fit any desired pattern. It comes along with the few cents worth of chemicals at birth, and its monetary value depends upon what the owner does with it. An Edison develops and guides his ego in the fields of creative investigation, and the world finds a genius whose worth cannot be estimated in terms of dollars. A Henry Ford guides his ego in the field of individual transportation and gives to it such stupendous value that it changes the trend of civilization by removing frontiers and converting mountain trails into public highways. A Marconi magnetizes his ego with a keen desire to harness the ether and lives to see his wireless communication system make the whole world akin by instantaneous exchange of thought. These men, and all others who have contributed to the march of progress, have given the world an idea of the power a well-developed ego represents. The difference between men who make valuable contributions to mankind and those who merely take up space is entirely a difference of ego, because the ego is the driving force behind all forms of action. Liberty and freedom, the two major goals of all people, are available to every individual in exact proportion to the development and use he makes of his ego. A brief analysis of these two desirable stations of life, liberty and freedom, will provide a better understanding of the potential power of the ego. You have liberty when no other person restrains, retards, or controls you in any manner. You have freedom when you do not restrain yourself through fear or self-limitation of any nature. Freedom is something which cannot be secured except through the efforts of an individual by proper development and use of his own ego. Liberty may be acquired through the aid of others. There can be no freedom without liberty, and there can be neither freedom nor liberty except by strict control and definite guidance of one's ego. It sometimes happens that men do not discover the real source of freedom until they lose their liberty and are forced to take introspective inventory of their own ego. Every person who has properly related himself to his own ego has both liberty and freedom in whatever proportions he desires. A man's ego determines the manner in which he relates himself to all other people. More important still, it determines the policy under which he relates his own body and mind, wherein is patterned every hope, aim, and purpose by which he establishes his destiny. A man's ego is his greatest asset or his greatest liability, and the only thing he may build to suit his own desires. Perhaps the most abused and misunderstood word in the English language is ego. This word has been abused by the common practice of associating it with vanity and self-love. Every highly successful person possesses a well-developed and self-disciplined ego. But there is a third factor associated with ego which determines its potency for good or evil, the self-control necessary to transmute its power into any desired plan or purpose. With this brief preparation, I am now ready to explain how I arrived at the conclusion that controlled ego is at the bottom of all human achievement. In the analysis, I shall reveal some of the results of 30 years of careful observation of the manner in which the mind operates, clearly indicating which of the observations are known facts, which are deductions. As I unfold this description of the great drama in which men create their own earthly destinies, it will become clear why knowledge, education, facts, and experiences are of themselves no guarantee of success. It will become clear also why some people are so long in finding the secret of successful application of the principles of achievement. This explanation will provide a guide to all who, in the future, wish to apply these principles with the object of achieving material success. I shall emphasize one important truth which, if properly interpreted, will give a new meaning to the principles of achievement. The truth I wish to convey is this: the starting point of all achievement is some plan by which one's ego can be made success-conscious. In other words, the person who succeeds must do so by properly developing his own ego, impressing it with the object of his desires, and removing from it all forms of limitation and dissipation. The place to start using the principles of achievement is in the development of one's own ego. Nothing that was uncovered during my 30 years of research was more impressive or helpful than the obvious fact that every man of outstanding achievement whom I analyzed had gained control of his ego. Autosuggestion, or self-hypnosis, is the medium by which one may attune his ego to any desired rate of vibration. Every successful person makes constant use of this principle. Unless you catch the full significance of the principle of autosuggestion, you will miss the most important part of this chapter, because the nature of a person's ego is due entirely to the extent of his knowledge and application of self-suggestion. Stating the matter in another way, before a person can sell the world any idea, he must first sell it to himself. Every master salesman, no matter in what calling, understands and uses this principle. If he did not understand it, he would not be a master. People who have what is popularly called a pleasing or charming personality are those who by chance or design have colored their own ego with definite positive qualities. No man can be master of anything or anyone to which his own ego is bound and fettered by fear or self-depreciation. No man can express himself in terms of opulence while most of his energies are required in a struggle against poverty. Nevertheless, one should not lose sight of the fact that many men of great wealth began in poverty, which suggests that this and all other fears can be conquered. There are hundreds of different parts to an automobile, every one of which is essential for the satisfactory and safe operation of the machine. These parts are so assembled and coordinated that they have been reduced to three important factors as far as the average driver is concerned, namely, 1, a steering wheel, 2, an accelerator, and 3, a set of brakes. Through these three points of contact, an automobile can be put into motion, guided over any desired course, and stopped at will. The human machine is infinitely more complicated than the automobile. It is subject to manipulation through many types of stimuli and many parts, but in the form of desires, fears, and emotions. In the final analysis, all the principles of success and all the principles of failure can be consolidated and expressed through one single factor, the human ego. The ego embodies the steering wheel, the accelerator, and the brakes with which the physical machine of an individual is started, guided, and stopped. In the one word, ego, may be found the composite effects of all the principles of achievement, coordinated into one single unit of power which may be directed to any desired end by any individual who is the complete master of his ego. The egotist who makes himself offensive is one who has not discovered how to relate himself to his ego in a manner which gives it constructive use. Most expressions of egotism are nothing but efforts to conceal inferiority complexes. The person who fails to relate himself to his ego in a manner that gives it constructive guidance is sure to make the same mistake in his method of relating himself to other individuals. Constructive application of the ego is made through expressions of one's hopes, desires, aims, ambitions, and plans, and not by boastfulness and self-love. The motto of the person who is on good terms with his ego is deeds, not words. The desire to be great is a healthy desire, but an open expression of one's belief in his own greatness is an indication that he is not carefully building his ego, and you may be sure his proclamations of greatness are but cloaks with which to shield some fear. The relationship between mental attitude and ego. Understand the real nature of your ego, and you will understand the real significance of the mastermind principle. Moreover, you will recognize the fact that to be of greatest service, the members of your mastermind alliance must be in full sympathy with your hopes, aims, and purposes. They must not be in competition with you in any manner whatsoever. They must be willing to subordinate their own desires and personalities entirely for the attainment of your major purpose in life. They must have confidence in your integrity, and they must respect you. They must be willing to support your virtues and make allowances for your faults. They must be willing to permit you to be yourself and live your own life in your own way at all times. Lastly, they must receive from you some form of compensation which will make you as beneficial to them as they are to you. Failure to observe the last requirement will bring an end to your mastermind alliance, no matter who you are or with whom you are associated. Men relate themselves to one another because of motive. There can be no permanent human relationship based upon an indefinite or vague motive. Failure to recognize this truth has cost many men the difference between penury and opulence. One of the first and perhaps the most important secrets of Andrew Carnegie's achievements was his method of maintaining his mastermind relationship with his business associates. He was a master at the business of selecting men for his mastermind group who brought with them not only knowledge and intelligence, but, what is more important, the ability to relate themselves to his ego according to its needs. When a certain man heard that Mr. Carnegie had permitted Charles M. Schwab to earn as much as $1 million in 1 year, he was curious to know what peculiar abilities or knowledge Mr. Schwab possessed which entitled him to receive so fabulous a sum, so he asked Mr. Carnegie to enlighten him. "Charlie Schwab's knowledge of the steel business," said Mr. Carnegie, "may not be worth a dollar more than $25,000 a year, but his personality and his influence upon me are so valuable that they cannot be estimated in terms of money. His very presence gives me the courage to think in bigger terms and the self-confidence to believe I can master all difficulties that get in my way." A man's ego is the focal point of his being in which is centered a perfect picture of himself. A picture into which has gone every thought he has released, whether of a negative or a positive nature. A picture in which is clearly reflected all his hopes, desires, and plans, all his fears and limitations, no matter from what source they may have come. By a careful choice of associates, with the aid of a definite purpose, a man may shape, develop, and guide his ego until it becomes an irresistible power through which he can appropriate whatever he wants of life. By neglecting to cultivate his ego, a man may drift with time and circumstance into the lowest depths of failure. The men of great achievement are, and they always will be, those who deliberately feed, shape, and control their own egos, leaving no part of the task to chance. So there may be no misunderstanding as to what I mean by the term properly developed ego. I shall describe briefly the factors which enter into the development, viz. First, one must ally himself with one or more people who will coordinate their minds with his in a spirit of perfect harmony for the attainment of some definite purpose, and that alliance must be continuous and active. Moreover, it must consist of people whose spiritual and mental qualities, education, sex, and age are suited to the object of the alliance. For example, Andrew Carnegie's mastermind group was made up of more than 20 men, each of whom brought to the alliance some quality of mind, experience, or knowledge not available through any of the others. Second, having placed himself under the influence of the proper associates, one must adopt some definite plan by which to attain the object of his alliance and proceed to put that plan into action. If one plan proves to be inadequate, it must be supplemented or supplanted by others until one is found that will work, but there must be no change in the purpose of the alliance. Third, one must remove oneself from the range of influence of every person and every circumstance which has even a slight tendency to cause him to feel inferior or incapable of attaining the object of his purpose. Positive egos do not grow in negative environments. On this point, there can be no compromise. The line must be so clearly drawn between a man and those who exercise any form of negative influence over him that he closes the door tightly against every such person, no matter what previous ties of friendship or blood relationship may have existed between them. Fourth, one must close the door tightly against every thought of any past experience or circumstance which tends to make him feel inferior or unhappy. Strong, vital egos cannot be developed from the all-too-prevalent habit of wallowing in the thoughts of unpleasant past experiences. Vital egos thrive on the hopes and desires of unattained achievements, and not upon thoughts of past failures. Thoughts are the building blocks of which the human ego is constructed. When the job is finished, it represents, right down to the slightest shades, the exact nature of the thoughts that went into it. It was his astonishing recognition of this fact that prompted Henry Ford to remove from his business family every person who was out of step with his business policy. It was his complete understanding of this truth that caused Andrew Carnegie to insist upon harmony between the members of his mastermind group and himself. Fifth, one must surround himself with every possible physical means of impressing his mind with the nature and purpose of the ego he is developing. For example, an author should set up his workshop in a room decorated with the pictures and works of the authors in his field whom he most admires. He should fill his bookshelves with books related to his own work. He should surround himself with every possible means of conveying to his ego the exact picture he expects to express. Sixth, the properly developed ego is at all times under the control of the individual. It must be guided to definite ends and constantly used. There must be no overinflation of the ego in the direction of egomania by which some men destroy themselves. Egomania reflects itself in a mad desire to control others by force, examples being such men as Adolf Hitler, Benito Mussolini, and Wilhelm Hohenzollern, former Kaiser of Germany. In the development of the ego, one's motto should be, not too much, not too little. When men begin to thirst for control over others, or to accumulate large sums of money they cannot or do not use constructively, they are treading upon dangerous ground. Power of this kind grows of its own nature and soon gets out of control. Nature has a safety valve through which she deflates the ego and relieves the pressure of its influences when an individual goes beyond certain limits in the development of his ego. Emerson called it the law of compensation, but whatever it is, it operates with inexorable definiteness. Egomania drove Theodore Roosevelt to attempt a third term in the White House. When he failed, his ego was so shaken that he soon died. Napoleon Bonaparte began to die because of a crushed ego the day he landed on St. Helena. People who retire from all forms of work after having led active lives generally atrophy and die very soon. If they live, they are miserably unhappy. A healthy ego is one that is always in use and under complete control. Seventh, ego is constantly undergoing changes, for better or for worse, because of the nature of one's thoughts. There is no adequate method of describing the exact period of time required for the transformation of a desire into its physical equivalent. The nature of the desire, the circumstances which influence it, the intensity of the desire itself, all of these are determining factors in connection with the time required for the transformation from the thought stage to the physical stage. The state of mind known as faith is so favorable to the quick change of desire into its physical equivalent that it has been known to make the change almost instantly. Man matures physically within about 20 years, but mentally, which means his ego, requires from 35 to 60 years for maturity. This fact explains why men seldom begin to accumulate material riches in great abundance until they are around 50 years of age. An ego which can acquire and retain great material wealth is, of necessity, one that has undergone self-discipline and has acquired self-confidence, definiteness of purpose, initiative, imagination, accuracy of judgment, and other qualities without which no ego has the power to procure and hold wealth. A few years before the beginning of the World Depression, the owner of a small beauty parlor turned over a back room in her place of business to an old man who needed a place to sleep. The man had no money, but he did have considerable knowledge of the methods of compounding cosmetics. Accordingly, the young woman who gave the old man a place to sleep provided him with an opportunity to pay for his room by compounding the cosmetics she needed in her business. Very soon, the two entered into a mastermind alliance that was destined to bring them economic freedom. First, they entered into a business partnership with the object of compounding cosmetics to be sold from house to house by agents, the woman providing the money for the necessary raw materials, the man doing the labor. Their first sales were made by themselves, the woman devoting her evenings to selling from house to house, the man also devoting a portion of each day to selling. After a few years, the mastermind arrangement between the two had proved so advantageous, they decided to solidify it by marriage. The old man had been in the cosmetics business for the better portion of his adult life, but had not achieved success. The young woman had barely made a living operating a beauty parlor. The happy combination of the two brought them into possession of power neither had known prior to their alliance, and they began to succeed financially almost from the very first day of their business alliance. At the beginning of the business depression, they were compounding cosmetics in one small room and selling their products personally from door to door. By the end of the depression, they had grown to where they were compounding their cosmetics in a large factory with over 100 employees working steadily and more than 4,000 salespeople selling their products throughout the country. During the first 10 years of their alliance, they accumulated a fortune of $2 million, despite the fact that they were operating during depression years when such luxuries as cosmetics were naturally difficult to sell. They have placed themselves beyond the need for money for the remainder of their lives. Moreover, they have gained financial freedom on precisely the same knowledge and the same opportunities they possessed prior to their mastermind alliance, when both were poverty-stricken. Interested in knowing the secret by which two practically unknown people of mediocre ability and little education achieved the miracle of legitimately accumulating a fortune during the days of uncertainty, I traveled halfway across the continent and became their house guest while I studied every detail of their business policies and every characteristic of personality of each of them. These circumstances under which I was privileged to analyze these people were such that I came back with the entire story, just as it had been lived. What a significant story it is. I wish the names of these two interesting people could be mentioned, but personal consideration prevents me from revealing their names. The motive which brought about the alliance of these two people, in their business and their marriage, was definitely economic in nature. The man is now 75 years of age. The woman is 40. She had previously been married to a man who failed to earn a living for her and deserted her when their child was an infant. My observation of these people at close range permits me to say there is not, and never has been, the slightest feeling between the two which even remotely resembles love. However, there is harmony between them. This is a significant fact in view of the great emphasis that Andrew Carnegie placed upon harmony as an essential in the successful operation of the mastermind. On the back of the lot on which their house is situated, they have an elaborate swimming pool which no one but the Lord and Master is permitted to use except on very rare occasions, on invitation from him. The house is elaborately furnished, but no one, not even invited guests, is permitted to take a turn at the piano or sit in one of the chairs in the living room without special invitation. The main dining room is equipped with ornate furniture, with a long dining table suitable for use on state occasions, but the family and guests are seldom permitted to use it. They dine in the breakfast room. A gardener is constantly at work on the lawn, but no one is permitted to cut a flower without special invitation from the man of the house. Nothing can be served at the table which the head of the house does not personally like. Such conversation as is carried on is conducted entirely by the head of the house. His wife never speaks unless she is definitely requested to do so, and then her speech is brief and carefully weighed so as not to irritate her master. Their business is incorporated, and the man is president of the corporation. He has an elaborate office furnished with a large hand-carved desk and overstuffed chairs. On the wall directly in front of the desk is an enormous painting of himself, at which he gazes with obvious admiration almost constantly. When speaking of the business, and particularly of the unusual success it has enjoyed during the country's worst depression, the man takes full credit for all that has been accomplished. So much so, in fact, that he never even mentions his wife's name in connection with the business.